Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We'll stay partly cloudy through the rest of this afternoon around the valley, looking for a possible high of 74. Partly cloudy tonight with lows in the lower 50s. Partly sunny, a little bit warmer tomorrow with a high of 79. Currently, relative humidity is at 21%. Partly cloudy and 66 degrees.
A Veterans Health Administration program has helped reduce hospitalization among homeless veterans, according to a report issued today. The Homeless Patient Aligned Care Team program, or HPACT, provides medical care outside traditional hospital settings. Homeless veterans who used HPACT services showed a nearly 20% reduction in emergency department use, according to the report. Shane Gruen is with the Arizona Coalition to End Homelessness.
And it's supposed to be in the community, a little less daunting for a lot of the veterans that are resistant to the VA, and a little easier to get to, hopefully, for a lot of them as well.
Overall, hospitalization among those veterans decreased by 35%.
Gas prices in Arizona jumped nearly 12 cents over the past week. A gallon of regular unleaded now costs on average $2.09. AAA Arizona attributes some of that to lingering refinery issues in California, although the group says wholesale prices there are stabilizing, which should stop double-digit increases in Arizona. But AAA also adds prices could still rise up to a quarter a gallon between now and Memorial Day.
Governor Doug Ducey has a bill on his desk that would revamp Arizona's campaign finance laws. The House approved Senate Bill 1516, largely along party lines, on Wednesday after hours of debate. Representative J.D. Mesnard, a Chandler Republican, backs the changes.
The Supreme Court has ruled that we have a right to associate. We have a right to speech, of which our money is speech. We have a right to privacy in those associations, and I think that should be respected.
But critics, including Democratic Representative Bruce Wheeler of Tucson, argued for more transparency.
Who is contributing to organizations that wish to propose or influence laws in the state of Arizona? I want to know who's behind that effort.
To get a sense of what exactly is in this bill, I'm joined by Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, it looks like this measure would lead to more so-called dark money in Arizona?
Well, that's what it appears to be, because right now, under state law, if the Secretary of State or the Clean Elections Commission determines that you're primarily organized for the purpose of influencing elections, you not only have to declare expenditures, which all groups do, but you have to provide your donors. What the bill would do is say, if you can get the IRS to recognize you as a so-called 501c4, a social welfare organization, we will presume that you're not organized for a political purpose. Now, never mind, the IRS doesn't police this. The IRS doesn't look at it. You can file for a 501c4, and then maybe a year and a half later, the IRS may say you don't qualify. But I think that's a very big concern, that the state is saying, we're going to get out of that business.
Another provision of this bill would allow campaigns to basically dole out money to other campaigns. So if there's a particular candidate that has a sizable war chest, they can decide which other candidates they want to give out that money to.
And this is very important, because that's the way it was until 1986. Burton Barr, who was the House Majority Leader, would get a lot of money from a lot of different sources. And then let's say he needed somebody's vote on something, and he would call them into his office and say, "So, Charlie, I hear you're having a little problem raising money. I can help with that, but I just need this little vote on that." And so the concern is that it leads to, you know, what Ken Clark, who's a foe of the bill, called a kingmaker provision. And right now, the 1986 law had made such inter-candidate transfers illegal. This would overturn that.
There's also a provision in this bill that changes the way that fundraising itself is actually done.
Oh, this is a fascinating provision. Right now, let's say I want to help you get elected to the legislature, and I can host a party, and I can spend $100 and get people to come, and you know, maybe for a $1,000 plate dinner. I mean, I don't know who'll come for $100. Maybe you'll cover the costs. This lifts all the limits. So let's say I want to help a few people get elected, and I happen to have money. I can spend $100,000 on a dinner, and none of that is attributed to the candidates. None of that is reportable. Now, the candidates clearly know who spent the money on their behalf. The public doesn't.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Since the Supreme Court's ruling in the so-called Citizens United case in 2010, states have been making changes to their campaign finance laws. To get a sense of where Arizona's approach falls, I'm joined by John Dunbar, political editor for the Center for Public Integrity. And John, how does SB 1516 compare to the approach other states have been taking?
Well, the National Conference of State Legislatures estimates or has identified about 38 states that have been working on these so-called dark money bills. And they've been looking for ways to get more information from organizations that are participating in elections. What's happening in Arizona is striking in that they seem to be going in the opposite direction and trying to pass a law that's actually going to produce less information.
Are there other states that have also taken this approach?
We're seeing in, for example, there in Wisconsin, where there was also a heavy influence from the Koch brothers, who seemed to pop up a lot on this dark money issue, where there was the elimination of a government watchdog agency within the government, and also on disclosure, they're eliminating the requirement for an employer, for a contributor to list an employer, which may not seem like much, but it's critical if you're trying to figure out if a company is trying to get influence over a particular politician.
One of the provisions that's gotten a lot of attention here is this idea that Arizona is basically ceding its oversight jurisdiction to the IRS in some of these social welfare groups. Are there other states that don't look at this, that let the IRS take care of it if that agency wants to?
I would say that we were looking at a status quo situation. What you had in Arizona was kind of an unusual situation where they were being monitored. In most cases, unless you do something, expressly, like to pass a piece of legislation or a rule, the status quo is going to be that no, you're not going to have disclosure. That it is going to essentially rely on the IRS for disclosure. So, it's what's different about Arizona is that you actually had a pretty good law. And if were it not there, then the only place you would be able to go to learn about dark money groups would be the IRS. What's happening in the states is, the one thing that the Supreme Court did say in Citizens United was that disclosure was absolutely allowed, and that the states have the power to require disclosure. And states are moving in that direction because the federal rule is so weak.
One other provision that I wanted to ask you about, which is what some critics here have called the kingmaker provision, which basically allows a candidate or campaign to dole out money to other candidates or campaigns. And as far as disclosure, somebody would know that the recipient of the money has gotten it from the original candidate, but not where that money has originally come from. Is that something that is common in other states?
At the federal level, we have these things called leadership PACs. These are controlled by members of Congress, and they use these PACs, these funds, to make friends and influence people on the Hill. But they are political action committees that are regulated, so you do know at least who the contributors are to those political action committees. And that's, as far as disclosure is concerned, that's about as much as you can hope for.
John Dunbar is the political editor for the Center for Public Integrity. John, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
The combination of government spending less money on infrastructure projects while roads and bridges across the country are in need of significant reinforcement is a troublesome one. What will it take to increase that investment? Is there an appetite for it at the federal level? Former U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood is in the Valley today, in part to tour Valley Metro's new Northwest Light Rail extension. LaHood is co-chair of Building America's Future, and he joins me now. So, Secretary, Phoenix has been known as the land of car culture. What are you seeing here now?
The people actually voted to increase their own taxes to pay for light rail. Mm-hmm. Phoenix could become a model for other places in the country. I think it sends a pretty loud message to Washington, D.C. We're not waiting around for you to find some money for us to do what we need to do to get people around our community. I think the other message is, if you're going to attract young people to the community, and what I mean by that are college graduates, the smart, up-and-coming people that you want to really become the core of your community, you have to offer alternative forms of transportation. A lot of young people don't want to own a car. They can't afford it. They don't want to pay the insurance, but they do want good transportation.
In the past, there have been big partnerships, big money coming from the federal government. Should we no longer expect that sort of thing to happen unless it's a project that everybody's on board with?
Well, even though Congress passed a transportation bill last year, in my opinion, it's a pretty chintzy bill. Currently, there are 57,000 structurally deficient bridges in America. America's one big pothole right now. Maybe not in this part of the world, but if you come from the part of the world where we live, whether it's in Illinois, where I have a home, or whether it's in Washington, D.C., these brutal winters have killed our road systems, and the federal government has not really stepped up and provided the kind of funding that we've traditionally known over a long period of time. And so some of us at BAF and other places have promoted the idea of raising the gas tax, which hasn't been raised since 1993. We need to get that big pot of money back so we can fix up the 57,000 structurally deficient bridges and fix the road systems in America.
So you seem very optimistic.
I'm optimistic because I'm in a community where people are doing things. They're making a difference. They're reacting to what the people want.
But do you think we're in a position now where we're going to have to, in communities, whether it's raising the gas tax or whether it's other forms of taxing ourselves to do this? Because these projects, even if people think they're absolutely warranted and needed, we're talking billions of dollars for these things. So do you think when people hear those numbers, though, are they thinking, I like the idea, but billions, well, that's going to, our taxes are going to go through the roof?
I think as long as people see progress, as long as people see their friends and neighbors working, as long as they see that this infrastructure creates the kind of economic development and economy, I think they're going to continue to want to make the investments. And I think Phoenix can also be an example to those that are serving in state government here that you're not going to get thrown out of office if you raise the gas tax and use the money, don't divert it, but use it for the purpose that it was intended.
You know, we're always looking for bipartisanship. Do you think this is an issue where that's a little bit easier?
Transportation has always been bipartisan. There are no Republican or Democratic bridges. There are no Republican or Democratic roads. And, you know, it's pretty interesting that I'm a Republican and I served as DOT secretary in President Obama's administration. Norm Mineta, a congressman from California, a Democrat, served in President Bush's administration as Secretary of Transportation. So the die has been cast when it comes to transportation. It's bipartisan.
Former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, he's also co-chair of Building America's Future. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
There are just three buildings left of the 27 that once made up Phoenix Indian School. The controversial boarding school closed 25 years ago, and most of the land became Steele Indian School Park in central Phoenix. Now one building is being restored to reconnect the Native community to this historical place. The show's Anika Klein takes us there.
The Phoenix Indian School Band was a centerpiece of the boarding school. It played in the first statehood parade on the day Arizona became a state in 1912. In fact, it led the procession down Washington Street. And this is where they practiced.
The larger spaces were for full band practice. Over
Patty Hibbler is CEO of Phoenix Indian Center, one of the groups involved in the restoration of this building. Construction just started. They'll try to keep much of the original structure, but the function of the space will be very different.
Right behind us here will be a business area. We really want to create a boardroom.
And a conference room in the back. The other major feature will be a commercial kitchen. The idea is to create a space for Native leaders, business people, and chefs. Dee Dee Yazzie Devine is president of Native American Connections, another major player in the restoration.
We want to see that people are here every day, that this building itself brings the community back to this site and really revitalizes some of the park as well.
And then there's the gallery, right when you walk in.
We want all Arizona children to know the story of the boarding school experience for Native American people.
It's a difficult story to tell, but Devine says the gallery will educate visitors on the school's history, the good and the bad. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, many Native American children were forced to attend Indian boarding schools like this one. There, Native culture was erased and replaced with Anglo customs and ideas. In later years, sending a child to a boarding school became a choice, but it was still a tough one.
I went to school there 4 years, 1952, and I graduated in 1956.
Douglas Sakiestawa made the most of his years at Phoenix Indian School. He was student council president and played trumpet in the band. He met his wife there, at a sock hop. She played baritone. They were good years, he says, but the hardest part was the disconnect he felt when he went back to the reservation.
I walk on this planet as an Indian, but I don't feel like I'm an Indian. Look to me like I'm completely assimilated.
But he says his education was invaluable because it helped him help his tribe when he returned home.
I'm helping the Hopi tribe doing research on water rights, so I'm doing things for them at a greater level than I would have been had I not been educated at Phoenix.
For 99 years, students walked the floors of Phoenix Indian School, carving their names in the bricks, singing songs in the choir, missing home. Devine says Native American Connections is in the process of interviewing alumni to preserve what happened.
It's really important to document those stories before they're gone.
These stories will be on display in the restored building, and the entire project is expected to be completed in spring of 2017. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
It's the show on KJZZ, along with the Takeaways' Todd Zwillick today. I'm Mark Brody. In California, drought has been a big problem, but over the last couple of weeks, it's been the opposite, as heavy storms have been pummeling the state with much-needed rainwater. That's good news for the drought-stricken region, but in Los Angeles, most of that stormwater runs right off and into the ocean.
L.A. City officials like Marty Adams, though, they're trying to change that. Instead of routing the rainwater away, doesn't it make more sense to capture it? Marty is Senior Assistant General Manager with the L.A. Department of Water and Power. He says that one obstacle is that L.A. was specifically designed over the last several decades to divert that stormwater into the ocean in order to avoid terrible floods. So a citywide effort to do the opposite is a huge undertaking.
We're looking at a situation where we've got to capture the water pretty much before it gets into the storm channels, because once it's there, it's on a fast path to the ocean. And so we want to try to catch it on property, on private property or public property, and really stop it and slow it down from actually getting into the streets and getting into the storm drains. And that's a big challenge.
How do you do that?
You know, we have a couple of large basins that we spread water in already, and those have been there since the 1940s, particularly in the San Fernando Valley. But at this point, you know, you can't go out and buy a large property and clear it of buildings waiting for it to rain. And so there's really not a lot of opportunities for big stormwater capture. So what we really have to do is have a lot of small projects. And so we are doing things on some of our streets. We're doing some places where in the parkways, instead of them running off into the street, we do a swale so the water can collect, or in a street median. We're doing work in our public parks to try to lower the grass level, so instead of the stormwater running off, it actually kind of pools and collects there. Sometimes in streets we put what we call dry wells, which places that water can infiltrate and not continue to run down the gutter. But ultimately, I think we're going to have to get on private property. There's only so much public property we can use. We basically have to get people to hold water in their properties, on their yards, and not have it run off so fast.
Well, is the idea then, if you're encouraging people to hold it on their own private property, modify that backyard or their storm gutters a little bit, to hold it on the property and use it in your own house, or to feed it back into the public supply? How does that work?
Well, you know, we have a program right now for rain barrels. They're like 55-gallon drums. Some look like drums. Some look pretty fancy, like big urns. And that would collect water off people's roofs down their gutters. And those kind of projects, people can then use that in their gardens during the course of the year. And then we're trying to grow that into what we call cisterns, which are basically larger capture facilities. And those, at this point, would help people offset their water use by allowing them to use that water outdoors. But ultimately, you know, the big benefit is to try to get more water into the ground, because there's only so much stormwater you can use on your property. But if we can slow it down by any of these methods to capture it and have it soak into the ground, it'll eventually become drinking water supply.
Okay, that all sounds great. So what is LA County or the other jurisdictions around the San Fernando Valley, around the area there in Southern California, what are they doing to give people an incentive to get these urns, to do all these things that help keep the water on the ground and then into the ground more efficiently?
So, you know, there are a number of agencies involved. Every city has its own runoff issues to deal with. LA County is a big player because they have, you know, regional control over stormwater. And then through the local wholesaler, Metropolitan Water District, there's actually a rebate program. And they'll rebate $75 a rain barrel and up to 4 rain barrels. So that's a good amount of money. It almost offsets the whole cost. And then in the city of Los Angeles, we actually add money on top of that.
Marty Adams, you know what you need?
What's that?
Your former governor famously sped around those storm drains on a motorcycle in Terminator 2. Great scene. You need the former governor to turn to the camera and say, get your system.
That's a good idea.
Marty Adams is Senior Assistant General Manager with the LA Department of Water and Power. Thanks, Marty.
Thank you very much.
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. Copper Canyon in northern Mexico cuts 6 slits into the earth, 4 of which are deeper than the Grand Canyon. Its jagged cliffs and remote valleys are home to an indigenous tribe made famous by its long-distance running.
It's here where an American concert pianist decided to settle with his 1-ton grand piano. From the Fronteras desk, KJZZ's Monica Ortiz Uribe tells us how he's connected with his native neighbors through music.
The short route to Romaine Wheeler's cliffside home in Mexico's Copper Canyon is on a 5-passenger charter plane. From the air, it looks like a glass cocoon clinging to the edge of a canyon wall. The landing strip is carved into a rocky mesa, flanked by a handful of adobe homes, each with its own tiny cornfield.
Romain, buenos días.
Buenos días.
¿Cómo amaneció?
On this sunlit morning, Wheeler, a 74-year-old classically trained pianist, comes out to greet the pilot and a couple of awestruck reporters. His light skin and blue eyes scream outsider, but his feet, caked in dirt and strapped in rubber sandals, look no different than the feet of the local Tarahumara Indians. Wheeler is an adopted son of this rugged landscape. He came here 30 years ago, wanting to unite his love of the outdoors with his passion for music. The view from his home studio is a spectacular panorama of mountain ranges.
I feel like I'm part of nature, and when I'm composing or writing, things flow very naturally without me having to look for them. It's utter bliss.
When he plays, Wheeler is like a bear on his piano bench. His fingers tumble across the keys like a river over boulders. This is a song he composed in honor of his favorite cottonwood tree. Its style is similar to native Tarahumara music, like this dance for violin and guitar. Getting a concert grant into the Sierra was no small feat. Wheeler had to move it in a dump truck, cushioned with 4 tons of potatoes. He rehearses every day. His career has spanned nearly half a century, and he's performed in 52 countries. Wheeler continues to give concerts and uses his earnings to fund a nonprofit that gives scholarships to Tarahumara children and staffs a local clinic he helped build.
There's such a high mortality rate in the children in the remote parts of the canyons here. In some places, up to half of the children die before the age of 10.
That's mostly due to disease and malnourishment. Wheeler's nonprofit, the Tarahumara Relief Fund, is modest, but sometimes gets a lucky donation from a big company or a foreign embassy. You're now listening to Wheeler's greatest beneficiary, a 29-year-old Tarahumara pianist. He's the first of Wheeler's 46 godsons, all natives. He's named Romano after his godfather. His last name is Gutierrez. The tune he plays is a Tarahumara deer dance.
Mis primeros recuerdos que tengo. My
first memories are sitting at my godfather's piano, Gutierrez says. At just 5 years old, his feet couldn't reach the pedals below. Today, he studies music at the State University in Chihuahua. Soon, he'll start his third European tour alongside his godfather. Back at home, Gutierrez says he's received with pride and respect. I want to continue in the footsteps of my godfather, he says. I want to help my community with music. Monica Ortiz Uribe, KJZZ News.
Researchers at ASU have found a way to do more with less on the farm. The work, which has been published in the journal Trends in Biotechnology, helps increase crops' yield while using fewer resources like water and fertilizer. Roberto Gagliola has been working on this. He's an associate professor at ASU dealing with the genetics and molecular biology of plants. He joins me. And Roberto, you found a way to basically make plants more efficient?
Yes. What we found is that when we increase the expression of an enzyme, the plants that have this expression enhanced move sugar more efficient. So plants make sugar via photosynthesis, and then that sugar needs to be allocated to different parts of the plant. One of the very important parts of the plant where this sugar has to go is the roots. If you have more sugar in the roots, your roots are going to grow more, and they're going to be more active. So that helps you to take up nutrients and water more efficient. The water and the nutrients will actually positive feedback regulate the capacity of the plants to grow also the upper soil parts of the plant, which are the new leaves and which are, of course, when it's time, the flowers, fruits, and seeds.
So how do you actually activate that enzyme to make this work? I mean, is it different in different kinds of plants?
What we have done is we have actually introduced a modified gene that encodes for this enzyme. We increase just the level of expression.
Is it an easy thing to do? I mean, if you have, for example, a field full of crops, would it be feasible to go and do this in every single plant?
No. What you have to do is you have to generate lines. Normally what we grow in our lands are monocultures of the same variety. So you first generate the construct via genetic engineering. You introduce that into the plants and you select the plants that have expression levels increased.
So what kind of implications might this have? If plants are more efficient and using less water and less of other kinds of resources, what kind of implications might this have for agriculture, both here in Arizona and elsewhere?
Well, for agriculture, it's going to be positive related to cost efficiency. So you're going to need to use less fertilizers and less water to reach higher productions. And it's also important to emphasize that one of the biggest problems we're generating with agriculture is eutrophication. We're actually, a lot of the fertilizer that we use in excess. If we place a ton of phosphate into the field, from that ton, you'll get half of it into the plant when very good, and the rest is lost, or stays in the soil, or goes into the water. That generates dead zones, and those are very negative for fishery productivity and other kind of lake productivity, too.
It sounds like it could be beneficial in places like Arizona where water is at a premium, where water is kind of scarce, where if you don't have to use quite so much of it on a crop like cotton, for example, you might be able to grow the same amount of cotton that you have been growing, but just use less water.
The idea of optimizing use of water, yes, that could be important, although here in Arizona, The gain of water use efficiency is always questionable because we need a lot of water to grow things here. But it's what it gives you is higher yields. So in a sense, you produce more.
Do you think that this could ultimately help grow enough crops to feed more people using less resources?
Certainly, especially in places where we have already conditions to grow and we need to optimize. We're, for example, now working with wheat. There is a very interesting group that actually has realized that with traditional breeding, we haven't been able to increase yields in wheat for the last 25 years. And now they're looking at different technologies, and our technology is one of them. So again, this is one way of doing it, might not be the only one. And what we're thinking is on trying to see if the different technologies can being added together so we can have an important impact in increases of wheat productivity, rice productivity, corn, the important staples.
Roberto Gagliola is with the ASU School of Life Sciences. His research on increasing crop yields appears in the scientific journal Trends in Biotechnology. Roberto, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
A state program to make sure students are reading at grade level before they can move on to fourth grade suffers from inconsistent oversight and administration, according to the Arizona Auditor General's Office. Jeff Gove is a performance audit manager in that office and worked on this report. He joins me. Jeff, what were you looking for in this audit?
So we were looking to see if if the program was being implemented appropriately out at the school districts and charter schools. And so what we looked at was a sample of school districts and charter schools in the state. And we went out to assess how they were implementing the program, whether they were spending the monies appropriately, and whether they were implementing other requirements of the K through 3 reading program.
And it looks like you kind of got mixed results on that.
That's correct. We did find that although most of the schools in our sample, in fact, all of the schools in our sample that we were able to assess, were spending the program monies appropriately for the most part, we did find that there was some inconsistency in the implementation of other program requirements.
Like what
so
kinds?
For example, we did find that the school districts and charter schools are actually required to submit a certain amount of information to the board, State Board of Education and the Department of Education to demonstrate their plan for improving the reading proficiency of K through 3 students. And in some cases, we found that some of the school districts and charter schools had not been properly submitting that information. In some cases, we found that they were not submitting some required information about the reading proficiency of their students based on assessments that they do at the beginning of the school year.
Did you get the sense that that lack of submitting of information was having an effect on the teaching and the learning that was going on inside the classroom?
What we found was that without the submission of that information, it's very difficult for the State Board of Education and the Department of Education to be able to assess whether or not the program is being implemented appropriately and is being implemented in the way that it was intended.
So it's really just a matter of without this information, we don't really know what's going on and whether or not it's working.
That's correct.
In its response, the chief of staff to Superintendent Diane Douglas wrote that the department seemed to agree with a lot of the assessments from your office and with agreed to implement some of the recommendations. But for many of them said that they would require more money from the state legislature. And I'm not asking you to pretend to be a lawmaker for a minute here, but would you agree with that assessment that in order for the State Department of Education to implement some of the recommendations from your audit, that it would need more money?
I think what we found is and what we recommended was that the department needs to take some steps to assess its workload and assess its current responsibilities as well as future responsibilities, including some of the recommendations that we made in the report. And if they do find that they need more resources, that there's several steps they could take, including looking internally for those resources, but then also, as appropriate, working with the legislature to, you know, gain more resources to do those types of things.
To your knowledge, and I don't know if this would have come out of your office or somewhere else, but have there been studies done or has there been data collected about whether or not the Move On When Reading program is working? I know it's still fairly early. It hasn't been in effect for terribly long, but do we know if this program is working?
I think what we found was that there is not a process in place to assess the outcomes of this program. And so we made some recommendations that the department actually establish a process to assess outcomes, as well as establishing a process to oversee the school district and charter school's own assessment of those outcomes.
Jeff Gove is a performance audit manager with the Office of the Auditor General here in Arizona. Jeff, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Relations between Arizona and Mexico get a lot of attention, but in recent years at least, the focus has been on economic and trade issues. Mexico is Arizona's largest trading partner, for example. Some of the most intense parts of the connection between the countries, though, come at the ground level, person to person. That's part of what has driven the success of the Arizona-Sonora Border Projects for Inclusion, which makes it possible for low-income people to get wheelchairs and prosthetics. Burris Duncan of the U of A College of Public Health is the co-founder of the effort, and he joins me. Burris, as a pediatrician, you'd work with disabled children. So in starting the projects for inclusion, were you thinking about specific kids or more broadly than that?
We'd see a lot of children who were in wheelchairs, and when wheelchairs broke, which they often did, I'd have to send the wheelchairs off someplace to get them fixed. And so for 2 or 3 months, the children would be without any ambulation at all. But that was locally. I've also done a lot of work internationally and have seen the devastation that children who have disabilities encounter and the barriers and problems they have traversing terrain that is very rough in other areas of the world.
So how has the progress been with the Border Projects for Inclusion? How did you find partners for that?
I can't begin to tell you what progress is going on. It just really is extremely exciting to me to look at what's happened. As I say, we started this project in 2008. At that time, what I wanted to do was two things. One, I wanted to establish a place where we would build a all-terrain wheelchair. It's called the Rough Rider, which was designed by Ralph Hotchkiss. He's a paraplegic himself and was in Nicaragua, he said, interviewing two individuals who were sharing a chair. And they looked at his very fancy, expensive chair and said, we know where it's going to break, and it did. And so he came back. He's an engineer. He came back and designed this Rough Rider wheelchair, which is extremely important and necessary in areas where the terrain is not smooth. And the durability of this is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, it just can't break, and it cannot tip over frontwards. I've actually gone down a flight of stairs with this thing, and it just won't tip over frontwards.
Wow.
If something should happen to it, a person can easily repair it by going to a hardware store or a bicycle shop and get the tools or the supplies he needs to make it functional again.
So how complicated is the process to get that to people south of the border who need it?
Our shop is in Mexico, in Nogales, Sonora, Mexico.
Do the people who need it come to you, or do you go seeking them?
No, the people who need it come to us. I mean, and people who go to other places in this world will come to us and say, is there some way we can get a chair for this person who lives in this particular area? I mean, these chairs have gone to Tanzania, they've gone to Peru, they've gone to Guatemala, to Honduras.
Was that hard to set up the system that way? Or was this something that, because people had the same goal in mind, it was maybe less bumpy than people would think?
With this project, we have three principles. One is we hire people who need the device that they're building. We do not give these things away. We want people to pay something for them, and I really don't care how much they pay, but I want them to pay what they can afford. And then obviously we have to get the rest of the money subsidized in some way, either through grants or through donations, to make sure that they can get it, because it costs us money to buy the supplies and the equipment we need to build them, and we have to pay salaries. So we're not giving them away. It's not a charitable thing. It's a matter of trying to fulfill a need for people who can't get it anywhere else.
So how much of your time is spent on the always fun raising money side of things?
The city of Nogales, Sonora, has given us a piece of land that we're going to build a building on to construct these medical devices. I mean, it's absolutely incredible what people do. I was down there, I guess, one of our clinics a few Saturdays ago, and people were waiting to get the device and get evaluated, and they were getting hungry. And I said, what am I going to do? And I looked up, and there was someone getting out of their car with a big tub of sandwiches. And they went around passing sandwiches out to everybody. Where'd these people come from? I don't know. They just came.
It sounds like a way to restore faith in humanity.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. You know, people, when they hear about something, they do good.
Burris Duncan of the University of Arizona College of Public Health, he's co-founder of Arizona Sonora Border Projects for Inclusion. When a batter hits a baseball well, you'll hear a special sound and the ball will travel a long way. That's called getting the bat's sweet spot. What if you were an up-and-coming young player, you'd already made it to the big leagues and wanted to know how often you were hitting that sweet spot, or develop quicker hands, or know whether the angle of your swing is productive? you may want to try a so-called smart bat. It's from a company called Zepp. Earlier this month at spring training in the Valley, Zepp showed off its invention and its new spokesman, American League MVP Mike Trout of the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. John Howard is in charge of product marketing for Zepp. So, John, how do you turn an average wood bat into a smart bat?
There's a lot of things that are taken into consideration. One, when we're taking a sensor and putting it in a bat, you don't want to disrupt the integrity of the bat itself. After that, then you have to start considering player safety and then also the feel and the integration so that it seems like the everyday bat that these players are used to swinging.
When I first saw the bat, my thought was, back in the old days as a kid, you'd put a donut on the bat, which is supposed to increase the weight, and then you take it off and the bat feels lighter. Is the sensor really, really lightweight so that it doesn't, as you talk about, impact the integrity of the bat?
It's extremely lightweight, yeah. So it's not affecting the integrity of the bat via weight or the way it feels or disrupting the strength of the bat. I like the comment you made about the donut and what our product does. It's almost like a mental donut, whereas now you're getting real-time data of your speed, and it's forcing you to work on your form and also how you're swinging the bat to increase those things. So the same way years ago the player would put on the donut, they'd swing their heart out, and then they'd remove the donut, and it'd be much easier to swing at a higher speed. This is just giving them real-time data to achieve the same thing.
So, John, is this based on a certain level of investment for folks? Can you do the app and then learn something? But if someone wants to make a major commitment, can they actually get it so it goes back to some processing area with Zepp, and then they can send them something via their phone or via their tablet or something like that to give them more specific insights?
The app is a free app. So any person that's interested in getting better at swinging a baseball bat can download the free app and all the training programs they'll have access to. The added value is when you make the investment to the sensor that goes into the smart bat, that's when you can use that real-time data, and the app will guide you on a path that's going to send you to the right training programs to make improvements where you really need it.
How long has this been in the works?
So the baseball product has been out for about 2 years now. And right now, the current product that's in market is a rubber mount that attaches to the knob of the baseball bat. And this is great for youth players because they can transfer the sensor from bat to bat. A whole baseball team can use the same sensor and get a ton of value out of it. But the next step that we saw that was logical was the integration into the equipment. So this summer is when the smart bat will first be available.
You're talking to a guy who's a little bit crazy, a little bit over the hill, kind of walks around the house with a baseball bat, likes to do batting stances of famous players. Is this the kind of thing that if I just want to learn about the swing or how close I am to some famous player, can this work for me as well?
So as a baseball fan, you can go into the app, download it, see their swing. Even if you're not taking swings, you can watch their swing in 3D, see the numbers, and even in video, and really get good analysis on what it takes to swing at that level.
John Howard of Zepp, the company behind Smart Bat Technology. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name's Garrett Lewis, a.k.a. Rowdy, and I'm at Pierce Park. We play basketball, like, every night. Oh! I'm never sitting down. I'm, like, always doing something. That's why they call me Rowdy. There's just a lot of people that come outside and play pickup ball with us. Overall, just different ages, older men that think they're better than us against, like, little freshmen. We were winning 20-16 and they made a comeback, but we still made the game winning shot, 21-18. It's fun because like you meet a lot of people and then you make more basketball chemistry.
That's Garrett Lewis playing pickup basketball at Pierce Park. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just want to tell us to stop hanging on the rim, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
The Phoenix Art Museum is celebrating 50 years of fashion starting on Saturday with a new exhibit showcasing more than 50 pieces from the history of fashion. And next year, ASU will start offering a degree program in fashion. Both are headed by Danita Sewell, the curator of fashion design at the Phoenix Art Museum. I met her at the new exhibit as well-dressed mannequins were being brought up to the space and asked her about the significance of the museum's five decades in the world of fashion.
A lot of museum directors are now looking to see how they can do fashion, and we already have a program going, and we have a terrific collection. And it was started early before the extreme rise in interest in fashion, so we were able to collect some early historical pieces that are very difficult to find now.
Has it become almost more acceptable to consider fashion as an art form now than it used to be?
Absolutely. And this has been building, I would say, over the last 20 years of fashion really gaining importance in museum programs.
How does a curator determine what is an important piece of fashion? I mean, in the art world generally, there are some very well-known important pieces. I mean, you think of the really big ones like the Mona Lisa, things like that. Even in this art museum, there are some very important pieces. How do you determine that in fashion?
Research. So I follow fashion, I've studied the history of fashion, and in my role as curator here, I'm not a fashion editor or I'm not a fashion designer. I am looking at the research, I'm looking back in history, I am seeing what designs were important in the history of fashion in different periods. I'm also looking at designers, what designers were important and what pieces in that designer's body of work is important. And that's how we're establishing the history of fashion. And like any area of art, it's subjective.
When you look at different periods, how much do you look to how popular culture depicts those periods now? For example, do you look to like what the actors on Downton Abbey are wearing, or something like what the actors on Mad Men are wearing, to determine what people perceive now of periods gone by?
That's a very interesting question. Yes, I am a Downton Abbey fan. And I think I look at it broadly, like what is interesting to people. This is still fashion, so it needs to be relevant to the time. That's what fashion is.
So in addition to the exhibit here at the museum, you're also going to be working on a new degree program in fashion design at ASU. Tell me what that's all about.
Well, I'm really excited about this venture with ASU. We're building a core of fashion classes that provide a foundation for people to then specialize either in business or sustainability or design or a number of different avenues, taking advantage of ASU and the many research initiatives that are already going on to distinguish these fashion students in the workforce.
So are these classes for students who want to become fashion designers? Is it going to be like Parsons, like you might see on Project Runway? Is this for more people like what you do who study sort of the history of fashion design?
Well, it's somewhere in between. Design will be a part of it. It's certainly not the only component. We're really opening it up to a lot of creative thinking and a lot of possibilities. I think one of the things I'm very passionate about is dispelling the myth of Project Runway. You know, that has really done a lot to popularize the field of fashion design, and we see a lot of interest in the field because of that, which is really amazing. But there's very few jobs of just being the designer. So the fashion industry itself has many, many jobs, many interesting, good-paying jobs of all types. And that's one thing I'm passionate about, is unveiling what the greatest range of possibilities are for these students.
Are there those kinds of jobs here in the Valley?
Well, while we don't have a significant fashion industry here, there's a lot of opportunities for students to learn here, to participate in the great deal of interest in fashion or beyond.
Danita Sewell is the curator of fashion design at the Phoenix Art Museum. The exhibit, Defining Moments, 50 Years of Fashion at Phoenix Art Museum, opens Saturday and runs through August 7th.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.